This is Earthwatch. My name is Robert Knight, and you people have made a beautiful show possible. I mean, not just us here, not just Barry and Moogie and me, but the listeners, because without that, there would have been no show. And Moogie, you are a true friend to WBAI and to me, and your experience with me has been one that meets what we all hope for, and that is the concept of redemption. And you've shared that with me, and I'm honored to have Barry with you here, and for the Peaceniks to shine a little bit of their grace on Earthwatch tonight. Thank you one more time.
I hate to wake you up to say goodbye, but the dawn is breaking, it's early morn. The taxi's waiting, he's blowing his horn. Already I'm so lonesome like a crowd. So kiss me and smile for me.
Oh!
more time, let me kiss you. Close your eyes, and I'll be on my way. I'll dream about the days to come, when I won't have to leave alone. About the times I won't have to say,
Earthwatch was brought to you live with portions on recording. You're tuned to WBAI in New York City. Listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio at 99.5 FM. Oh, well, there goes my intro and outro and all that. I have to admit that I'm being technologically taken back, not because we ran over by a minute and a half, but because our guest this morning, Graham Slight, is in England, in London. And while other people do this regularly, I do not. So I'm using Skype on this computer. And it says right now that he is offline. I don't know if he's listening to me via the internet. But you know what? I actually have a way, if I need to, of getting in touch with him otherwise. So just bear with me as we prepare. And I apologize for the, unprofessionalism of it. And let me say thank you to Robert Knight for broadcasting that Moogie Klingman remembrance. It's sad, you know, when you lose somebody who has been such a part of the community for so many years. Ooh, okay. Okay, Jim, I'm online. Technology is wonderful. Okay. Great. He just texted me, and he gave me an alternative, and I am going to try that. So, let me try this. Hold on. Everybody bear with me. Oh, here we go. Look at that. Graham, are we there? It says there's a problem with the internet connection. Check your microphone. Okay, you know what? I'm going to use the other technology that I was about to use. The one that starts with the number 44, because I have been given a way of doing it. Let's see. I call overseas so rarely. Okay, let's try that again. did that work? No. Our computer is not accepting his Skype phone call. So hold on. I need to try dialing that number again. Okay, I'm doing something wrong. I think I need to prefix that phone number. Really? The number I've dialed is unallocated. How strange. They do these things in England. You know what? I am going to beg everybody's pardon for a moment. Put on a brief cut of music. And Sydney's... I'm going to ask Sydney to if he's available to give me a hand. Stand by.
did not come at noon, and out of the tawny sunset, before the rise of the moon, when the road was a gypsy's ribbon, looping the purple moon, our ragtime troop came marching, marching, marching. King George's men came marching up to the olden door. They said no word to the landlord, they drank his ale instead, but they gagged his daughter and bound her to the foot of her narrow bed. Two of them knelt to the casement with muskets at the side. There was death at every window, hell at one dark window, for Bess could see through the casement the road that he would ride. They had tied her up to
Graham, if you are listening, this Skype here isn't working. It says it's got some kind of internet problems. And the number that you last texted me says it is unallocated, a message that I have never gotten here before. So try IMing me again, and we'll see if we can't get this thing worked out. And I apologize to the audience, but this is, well, this is WBAI's attempt at working with modern technologies. And, well, I just think there are easier ways for us to try to manage calls here internationally. You know, I should have talked to Les Lister, whose show is on after mine. Okay, Sydney, if you are hearing me, I've got another number. Just to, by the way, make things even more interesting, I understand that we have, building issues, smoke alarms going off, which makes things more interesting, don't they? Okay, no, that's not... Okay, let me try this. Okay, he has sent another message. Let us see now. Okay, and... Let's see now. I press this. And, okay, here, now I'm at least communicating. Unallocated. That's a term I've never used. I've been saying this before, but again, I don't know the London phone system here. Okay, here we go. Yeah, calls to me get picked up, and then you get silence. And I know that. It's really annoying, but... man, let me try it through here. Now, I'm calling him through Skype. Let's see if this works at all. See, I'm not... Whoops. Let's kill that music. I've given up. Nah, it just says, check your microphone. So... Skype isn't properly set up here at WBAI. I've lost Sydney. Ah, little disasters. And I feel terrible. Okay, he sent me another number again. Aha! This one has a prefix. Okay. Now, if I can figure out how this works. Sydney, if you are... There's a trick to using this phone, to dialing out, and I don't know what it is. So if you can hear me, this morning's Hour of the Wolf would go much, much, much better. Because as I say, yeah, there is a trick to this involving this wonderful technology that we've got. And trying this again. Yeah, and it just says... You know, that it's not going to take... Yes, the speakers are working fine. It says my microphone isn't working. But, of course, we're using our console here. Sigh. Okay. I've tried both analog in and digital in. So, going to have to decline that there. And... I'm going to try this. Hello, Graham. Okay, so I'm fine. I've got you on a phone now, but I don't yet have you on the air. Skype here isn't working. It's our wonderful WBAI technology. It says my microphone doesn't work. Aha. Yeah. Now I have to figure out how to transfer you from this phone. There's Reggie. Reggie is in another studio across the way. Maybe he can save me. Reggie or Sydney, either of you. Graham, hold the line. I will be right back. Okay, and listeners, I will be right back. I'm actually going to run outside and see if I can get something. Reggie, Sydney, anybody, can you help? Come in. Okay, so at least I got the ear of somebody. And let us see what we can do. Good morning, Reggie. Thank God you're here. Why are you here? Okay, I've got my guest on the phone.
Right.
I've got to put him on the air.
Okay.
How does this happen? Skype isn't working.
Oh, really?
Yeah, really. It says the microphone doesn't work.
Really?
Yeah, it doesn't matter. We're live on the air. And we're 20 minutes into my show. I'd like to put my guest on.
They're not on, and you can't hear them right now?
Well, I've got them on the phone. I just called.
Okay. So...
Yes, Tony. Yeah, I mean, what do I do to put this call live?
All right, wait, hold on. Where's the
Graham,
number?
Bear with us. I've got him on the phone.
No, but... okay.
Oh, I mean, he's Graham Slide over here. Okay, I should press this button? Okay, hold on, Graham. We may or...
Oh, wait, try it now.
Okay, and are you there?
I'm there.
Oh, you thank there, God. Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. It only took three engineers.
Yeah.
Okay, you're now live on the radio.
Wonderful.
It only took 20 minutes.
What a science fictional future we all live in.
Yeah, exactly. Welcome to the 21st century. Reggie, everybody, thank you.
Okay.
Jesus. Good morning, Graham.
So, how are you this morning, Jim?
Oh, how do you think after all that? And I was running a cold. I think I emailed you about that. So, aside from the fact that I'm running a cold and Skype here isn't hooked up to the computer the way it's supposed to be. It says your microphone isn't working. So, I could Skype you, you could Skype me, but we just couldn't get it on the air.
Okay.
Then the outgoing call wasn't working. Now it worked, but there was a special magical button. It actually says, counterintuitively, off. I had to press the off button to put you on the air.
Okay.
Outside of that, I am fine.
Okay.
I'm being sarcastic.
You're just a little faint, Jim. I can hear you, but... excuse me if I ask you to repeat the odd question.
Absolutely. And my questions will tend to be odd. At any rate, good morning. Let's tell people who you are.
You want me to do this?
I can do it. Well, Graham Slight is first and foremost, I would say, best known as a critic and commentator and pundit on everything within the worlds of speculative literature and broadcast and movies, the genres in general, and occasionally stepping outside the genres. Most specifically, he is co-editor of version 3 of the Encyclopedia of Science Fiction, which is now online and free, where it used to be a costly book. Problem is that with my last edition of the book, I would have writers who came in on the show autograph their entry. I can't do that anymore.
You could print the thing out. I mean, it would be a stack of printout about 2 foot high, but you could.
Yeah, I would say so. And then it would be out of date by the time the print job finished.
Yeah.
And most recently, you have a new book out?
I have a new book which I've just delivered, which I think is coming out in the autumn of next year about Doctor Who.
Oh, okay. Which is a topic that I really don't deal with every week. It's every other week. And I just
It was Doctor Who Day yesterday, so I feel we kind of ought to.
Yeah, and you know, Doctor Who is, well, we'll get to that. I finally, by the way, just for by way of prepping, I finally watched the last Doctor Who Confidential a few hours ago. And if only for the chronology of Riversong, it was worth the price of admission.
Yeah.
And by the way, that's a show that...
It's nice to finally have that set out.
It really is, although, of course, that's a program that is not broadcast here.
So you get the main show, but you don't get Confidential.
That's right.
Right.
And the fact that it's been canceled, which is, you know, I follow it, but I have my evil ways of obtaining materials that are broadcast in England and not broadcast in the U.S. And I won't go into those on the air, but I mean, I will sorely, sorely miss that show. And for people who don't know what Doctor Who Confidential is, we get occasionally like 10-minute long pieces that are cut in and put in between commercials. We get that much of Confidential, and occasionally they'll do a 1-hour special, you know, maybe once a season. What there you call a series, here we call a season. And and outside of that, no, we get nothing. We don't even get it, by the way, on the DVDs.
Right.
And this is probably, I've always assumed, because of music rights.
I guess so. I mean, at least over here, there is so much stuff around Doctor Who that's promotion of the brand as it is now, rather than Doctor Who stuff itself. So you've got the website, you've got the interactive adventures they're doing from the BBC website. You've got
which we can't even, by the way, access. The moment that you try, you're told, "Hey, you're on the wrong continent for this." It was like trying to call you this morning.
Well, you can't blame the BBC for that.
No. No, no, that's WBAI. It's a different broadcast entity.
But with the same resources.
Yeah, well, yeah, actually, if you go back far enough, and I've been working here long enough, there was a time when we were pretty much the New York broadcast outlet for a lot of the BBC entertainment. We broadcast The Goon Show. It was on my show. That was the original bona fide premiere, the unbonafide actually premiere of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, where we had a copy that was accidentally left behind by Douglas Adams. About 2 years before National Public Radio broadcast it, and about 2 weeks before my counterpart in California, Mike Hodel, played it.
So you had the U.S. premiere.
I myself had the U.S. premiere. Very proud of that. Mm-hmm. Although it says on Mike Hodel's entry in Wikipedia that he had it, but it's from people who loved him. He died quite a few years ago, and he was a lovely, wonderful person. But the fact of the matter is that Douglas visited us here at WBAI, and 2 weeks later visited him there at KPFA, which is our KPFK, excuse me, which is our Los Angeles station. So I broadcasted the day I got it. He broadcasted the day he got it. But he was 2 weeks after me, so there. But I'm not gonna go into Wikipedia and steal his thunder.
That's very, very kind of you.
Oh, he was a wonderful guy. And his
Anyway. What can we do for you this morning?
Well, we do have to do one piece of business. Which is a sad piece of business. We have to do an obit.
Yeah.
And gee, I had one printed. It's like everything I've been doing this morning. Ah, there it is on the floor. Pardon me. But Anne McCaffrey, one of the few people I never interviewed. Did you ever interview her?
No, I'd never met her.
Yeah. I met her once, very, very briefly. She was in New York for an event not long after Pern was first published. So this is very late 60s. And that was it. I got an autograph. And she was living in the U.S. at that time. Now she was living in Ireland, and she was 85 years old, died of a stroke, I guess, 2 days ago. Yeah. And for those who don't know, she wrote the Pern books, P-E-R-N. And I would say that she was one of the first people to write what are now called young adult books that really did a lot of opening up for gender.
Mm-hmm.
And really connected with a lot of people, including young women, which most science fiction in those days, science fiction and fantasy, was not.
Mm.
And she changed the field in a number of ways. Whether you adored the Pern books or not, she was great and important and a lovely person, by all accounts.
Yeah, I mean, I think if I could just add to that, the thing I'd say, judging from the reactions I've seen online and on Twitter since her death was announced, 2 days ago?
Yeah.
Is that, yes, the Pern books appealed to young women, but also to men too. That the, as it were, the gender split you might have thought there was isn't as cut and dried as perhaps a lot of people had imagined, that
My take was that it did appeal to men, but it's just that a lot of other science fiction didn't appeal to young women.
Mm.
And Pern did. So it's not that there was a gender split. I think what distinguished it was is that there wasn't a gender split for one of the first times.
Mm. And, of course, I mean, again, it's a bit of a shock when you see that Weir Search, I'm never quite sure how to pronounce that, was first published in Analog. The story that sort of defined her reputation, I guess, was published in the central hard SF magazine of the field.
Yeah, and it's really, you think of dragons, you think of fantasy, but she thought of it initially as a science fiction world.
Mm. I mean, I've seen a certain amount of back and forth online in the last couple of days about was it SF or was it fantasy, and I suggest that this is fairly early on, this is a career that suggests the distinctions between SF and fantasy are not as clean-cut as many people would like, you know, that these are works that maybe feel like fantasy in some respects, but can absolutely be justified as SF.
Yeah, and ultimately, I put it in the WC, the Who Cares, it's genre. It's one, you can escape the question by saying it's speculative fiction, which, you know, for those who think that that's a new term, I like to remind people was a term coined by Heinlein in the late 40s.
Mm.
It came into usage, what would you say, Graham, in the 80s?
I remember seeing, I think in the introduction to Harlan Ellison's Dangerous Visions, Ellison talks about speculative fiction as his preferred tag for for what's in that book. And
yeah.
So that would be what, 1967?
Yeah. Yeah, but I think it became more common for people to just abbreviate it and say things like spec fic.
Mm-hmm.
And use it in modern parlance when trying to deal with the indefinable, like Kelly Link, to name one writer.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose there have always been writers who defy easy categorization one way or another, and so, you know, again, that you have similar arguments with McCaffrey to what you had with Gene Wolfe's Book of the New Sun in the early 80s.
That's right.
That these are stories that, again, have the feel of fantasy, but there's very little in there that can't be justified quite strictly as SF.
In which case, I call it science fiction. I'm footloose and fancy free, and when I talk about science fiction, I'll throw Tolkien and it's definitely not science fiction. There's no way that it is. But it's part of the same genre that we're all talking about. I know Lester Del Rey just took another turn in his grave when I said that.
So you think of Tolkien as science fiction because he's part of the same kind of conversation as Heinlein and Asimov at and Bester at the same sort of time?
Exactly, because he's part of the same conversation, although the term obviously cannot fit. I think in one of the chapter headings of Hartwell's Age of Wonders, he says why science fiction is the wrong and only name for it. I won't say it's the only name for it, but I will say that using the term science fiction as all-inclusive is a forgivable faux pas.
The wrong and only name for it. Well, David does enjoy being provocative about these.
Yes. Well, what do you say? I mean, you're as learned and important as David.
I'm sure I'm not, and I certainly don't have his dress sense. But sorry, Jim.
No, I was going to put words in your mouth. I'd rather hear your words in your mouth.
I think when doing something like this encyclopedia, or you know, judging for an award that for science fiction novels, I have to say to myself, you know, this is a bit of a fiction. That it is absolutely arbitrary, in a sense, where you draw the line around science fiction. And so, as I've said in a couple of places already, if China Mieville hadn't published Embassy Town earlier this year, which is, you know, a clear SF book, you could have argued either way whether there should be a China Mieville entry in this encyclopedia, on the basis of books like Perdido Street Station and King Rat and City in the City.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, City in the City has been acclaimed and has won awards on both the science fiction and the fantasy sides of the fence. But it's certainly very difficult to justify as the kind of science fiction that, say, Heinlein might have recognized. But equally, a criterion that says it can only be SF if Heinlein would have recognized it as SF, or John W. Campbell, or Horace Gold, or whoever.
But you're also
probably, by its nature, not a dynamic criterion. It's not one that reflects the fact the field is changing.
Exactly. Because every name that you mentioned were people whose era sort of started moving on, at least as of the late 50s.
Mm-hmm.
Even though Campbell was continuing and had, you know, he had two books. He had both Astounding and Fantastic. Unknown Worlds.
Yep.
Astounding and Unknown.
Was it not just Unknown? Magazines aren't my favorite.
I'm sorry. Anyway. I think it was Unknown, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that I'm going to get an email from Barry Malzberg, who often listens to this show and will always correct me on these things because I'm always wrong. And as we all know, he's always right.
I've had many conversations with Barry in which we've expressed different views.
Ah, yeah, well, you're both always right, so there. You see, my point of view is a totally different one, and it's really a devil may care point of view. Is, gee, did you like the book? And I know you can't get away with that when you're doing something that is as definitive as an encyclopedia. And in fact, when Volume 2 came out, we had John Clute on the air, live in studio. We didn't have problems. And, you know, we talked about, you know, the forthcoming Encyclopedia Fantasy, which was a couple of years later. And how do you, you know, where do you draw the line? Why do you draw the line? And there are very good reasons to draw that line. You just have to make sure that that line is broad and fuzzy.
And so that second edition has, I think, quite an extensive entry on Tolkien in it.
Yes.
But not doesn't really offer coverage of many other fantasy authors. And I suppose the logic that you get to there is, well, Tolkien has, even if you don't think a word that he wrote is science fiction, the fantasy rules, the fantasy game, as it were, that he established has been hugely influential on a lot of SF, and you leave a big gap in your understanding of the SF field if you don't understand Tolkien's influence.
Very much so. And as I like the word that you used earlier, that they are often part of the same conversation. I think it's a great way to express it.
I think with Tolkien, it's kind of a special case, though, because, you know, he obviously didn't come out of the SF conversation. You know, this is someone who is a very serious scholar of medieval and Anglo-Saxon literature, who was a very serious scholar of the Norse sagas and so on. And it's certainly easy to think of Tolkien influencing the SF world. It's much less easy to think of the SF world influencing Tolkien.
That's absolutely true. That was, in his case, sort of a one-way journey. But again, that was an earlier era. And I wonder if that is as true of today's fantasy writers, like, oh, I don't know, Brandon Sanderson.
Sorry, you mean that there's more back and forth in terms of what kind of career one can have and where one gets one's influences from?
Well, partly, but where one gets one's influences from. Certainly, Tolkien was informed by history, by historic mythology. But I think that Tolkien, as you said, informs modern science fiction. And not just Tolkien, but C.S. Lewis and a lot of the other fantasists.
Well, I suppose what you're talking about here requires me to mention a scholar whose work I really don't like, which is Joseph Campbell and the Hero with the Thousand Faces, and the idea that there is at root one story of quest and discovery and death and rebirth that gets remade time and time again in different cultures and different contexts and as we'd say, different genres. And I don't like that argument that Campbell has very famously put forward in Hero with a Thousand Faces for a couple of reasons. Firstly, because it seems to me incredibly reductive, and it's far more interesting to settle on or look at the differences between iterations of stories than similarities. And if you narrowly take Campbell as a template for a story, you get something like the Star Wars saga, which, for all its extraordinary, you know, wonders and visual splendors and all that stuff, as a story is pretty second-hand and uninteresting, I think. And also, to be honest, because Campbell's version of what a story should be shaped like is one that's very much reflecting a male-dominated culture, And we'd say, I'm sure rightly, that this idea that the hero is axiomatically a man, and that the summit of what he can achieve is taking possession of a woman in some form, is a notion that I and other people might have a few problems with. But that's not to deny that consciously or unconsciously, that way of thinking about stories has permeated a lot of places.
I would argue that Campbell's premise applies as a theme, not a rule.
Mm.
And that theme does not apply to all fiction. And I'm sure if we all worked at it, we could find the exceptions.
Sure. But, I mean...
So I agree with you. I find him an interesting scholar, but I disagree with him as well.
When I read the last Harry Potter book, and I do have written proof of this, so this is not just me claiming hindsight, I sort of said to myself, you know, even if J.K. Rowling has not narrowly followed Joseph Campbell in how she's plotted this, there has got to be a death and a rebirth. There's got to be some kind of journey to the underworld for the hero and then a return to the world, because that's the shape these big stories have. And in due course, of course, there was.
Mm-hmm.
And you get that pattern or that move occurring time and time again in these stories.
It does. So this still brings us to a place, I guess, of drawing lines and definitions and how the genres, however we may term them, change. And what does one do? I mean, what were the problems that you were faced with in putting together the Encyclopedia of Science Fiction, and how did you determine where the lines were?
Well, I mean, I think the first thing to say is that I've done far less on this than John Clute or David Langford, who are the editors with a capital E of this enterprise.
Yeah, we should. This is the third edition, and John worked on all three.
Yeah,
and he worked on the Encyclopedia of Fantasy. So clearly, and of course, as I said, I had him on the show. He dealt with this very question.
And I, to be really pedantic about it, my title is managing editor, and a lot of what I've been responsible for is looking at what we can provide on the website, trying to make sure that the website works as well as it can, spreading the good word about the SFE. I've written quite a bit of stuff. It certainly feels like quite a bit of stuff. But compared to John and David, it's a much smaller contribution because I'm a guy with a day job, and they're both freelancers. So with that proviso, I think I'd say we've taken a fairly broad church view of what's included and what's excluded. That we wouldn't want to exclude an author just because of, as it were, something that's arguable, something that you could challenge. And so, for instance, the fact that City in the City has won the Clarke Award, which is explicitly an award given for science fiction, would probably, as it were, qualify it for an entry, even if nothing else applied, because we're saying, okay, a significant chunk of the community or a significant element of the SF community thinks this is science fiction. So I think the overall aim is to not exclude anything unless it's very clearly fantasy or very clearly not SF.
So the idea is to let fantasy define itself and to put the rest into the science fiction phraseology term.
I mean, one can imagine, and I'm certainly not saying I'd volunteer for this or anyone would, one can imagine an overarching encyclopedia of the fantastic, which would encompass SF and fantasy and horror. And it seems to me that it's relatively easier to draw a line between the fantastic and the non-fantastic than it is within the fantastic field. You know, whether you
count. Give me an example. I've just been reading Michael Shea's The Autopsy in the Vandermeer's new anthology, The Weird, and that's an SF story, and it's a horror story. And it was recognized for awards, I think, on both the SF and the fantasy side of the fields. But unless you get away from the binary model of thinking, a work is SF or it isn't, a work is horror or it isn't, it's just increasingly difficult to come to a stable reading of what a lot of the things that you read or that you see on TV are.
Yeah. I mean, I know one writer, a short story writer, who sometimes writes certain stories, and she has never been concerned about whether this is definable as science fiction or fantasy. They're fantastic stories, and she certainly never thought of them necessarily as horror. And lo and behold, she got 3 citations one year in Ellen Datlow's honorable mentions for horror. And this, one of the same stories got a citation in both the Best Science Fiction of the Year and the Fantasy of the Year.
Hmm.
So well, one story won the Triple Crown there.
Let me throw out one other thought here, which is a sign of the kind of times we're in about genre boundaries, is not only that, as you say, you have works and indeed whole writers' careers which play with these boundaries, but you have works that actually play with this within a given work. And the example I'm thinking of is, do you remember the David Fincher film Seven from about 10, 15 years ago?
I am sorry to say I never saw it. I actually read the novel upon which it was based, but I know of the film at any rate.
Well, let me paraphrase it a little, and I suppose I should give spoiler warnings that I'm going to spoil a film that's 15 years old.
Oh, especially when we get to Whoville. We'll just warn listeners now. And actually, you and I and John Klute started a panel about 2 years ago at ReaderCon.
Yeah.
In which before I was the moderator, and before I could say a word, Klute said, "There is no such thing as a spoiler."
Yeah.
So I'm not sure if I agree with that or not, but let's just tell listeners right now, in the words of Riversong, spoilers. We're going to be doing them.
And I have to say, wearing my encyclopedia hat, we have had people upset that our entries have spoiled works that are 30 plus years old. But we move on. So Seven is a film about a series of killings that take place in an unnamed American city. And that seemed to be structured around the idea of the seven deadly sins. And so you find the first killing is someone who's guilty of gluttony being fed to death. And it's a fairly gruesome and graphic film. And about 3/4 of the way through the film, the two detectives who are chasing this killer, who are played by Morgan Freeman and Brad Pitt, capture the guy who's been doing it, and it's very clear that he's been doing it, and he's played by Kevin Spacey, and very little is known about him, and so he's simply called John Doe. And at this point, I think 5 of the 7, as it were, appointed killings have taken place, and Spacey essentially cuts a deal and says, "I will take you to the place where the remaining killings have happened, but I'll only do that I will only sign a confession if you let me do that." And so Freeman and Pitt are talking before they go and ride in the car with Spacey to the destination where this is happening. And at this point, so much of what Spacey has done seems almost supernatural. You know, it might just be explicable rationally. But, you know, this is someone with astonishing will and commitment to what he's doing, an astonishing capacity to inflict pain on others and himself. And you start to ask yourself, is this person who Kevin Spacey is playing really human? And at some point in their conversation before they go and get in the car with him, Morgan Freeman says to Brad Pitt, you know, if we go to this place, and John Doe's head splits open and a flying saucer comes out, I don't want you to be surprised. And what that's doing, apart from, you know, establishing how the sort of paternal relationship between the two works, because Pitt is very much the inexperienced guy here, is saying to you as a viewer, you don't know what genre this movie is going to end in, do you? You don't know whether there might be a science fictional explanation for this. There could be. And we're just going to play with that, and we're just going to leave that possibility out there. Just as we're going to leave the possibility that this is all explicable and mimetic. And I think you see an increasing number of works playing with that question of what kind of work is this within the frame of the story itself. I've shocked you into silence.
No, not at all. I'm listening and tasting what you have said and mulling it over. And remembering, by the way, why I've never seen the film, because you did talk about its graphic nature.
Mm.
And good or not, and this is, you know, I'm not recommending or not recommending to people, I tend to have an aversion to certain graphic depictions.
Sure.
And
no, I can quite understand that.
For reasons of sleep at night. I won't say it's good, justified, unjustified. I don't go there. I just say it's not for me to watch. It's just a personal choice that I prefer. I have images like those from my childhood when I didn't judge for myself which I should do. And I still dream about those. So I opt not to see a lot of films for that reason. And unfortunately, since the 80s, since the slasher era, we've become numbed by it.
Yeah. No, I can certainly believe that.
And whereas, you know, in something like Seven, obviously, that's a warranted inclusion, it's just not the best film for me to watch.
Sure. But yeah, I mean, I can't remember if you were at or on another panel at ReaderCon. And I guess I should explain that ReaderCon is an annual speculative fiction conference that happens near Boston in July, where a lot of critics and writers gather. And we did a panel about a book that Gary Wolfe, the great SF critic, has published this year called Evaporating Genres.
Now, I was not on that panel. I did attend it, though.
Where Gary is arguing very similarly to what both you and I are, that the characteristic of what's happening now in all the literatures of the fantastic is this blurring of boundaries and so on. And David Hartwell, who we mentioned earlier, was also on the panel and put the counter-argument, which is that an awful lot of interesting stuff is happening in core science fiction. And he specifically cited Peter Watts and said, you know, I think Peter Watts is the most important hard SF writer out there at the moment. And people, books like this, really aren't paying attention to it.
Yeah, I love his stuff. I hadn't thought about it in those terms, but
there's always a thing as a critic, as a reader of any kind, which is what you see shapes how you view the world. You know, that if you set out looking for things that blur genre boundaries and mess with your expectations, you'll probably find them. If you set out looking for hard SF, you'll probably find it. One of the big challenges, I think, for everyone who's reviewing or writing in this field is the field is simply too big to keep a handle on. You know, you can't read everything. You can't read whatever it is, two novels, three novels a day, just to stay abreast of things, let alone all the short fiction.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to filter. And the concern is that you shouldn't filter just to the kind of stuff you're comfortable with. You know, you have to read outside your comfort zone.
Yeah. I mean, I applaud. I see both sides of that argument. And I recognize certainly what Hartwell says. And I love the fact that there is a defender of the cause for hard science fiction, because for a long time on bookshelves here, and I assume it's similar in the UK, fantasy has been dwarfing, the good term for it, dwarfing the hard science fiction on the shelves. But hard science fiction lives as a very specific genre with very specific definitions, just as fantasy lives as a very specific, you know, the moment that you say elves and don't discuss DNA, I think that you have definitely, you know, gone into the fantasy territory. But there's still, nevertheless, I think, this big, big circle that encompasses both. And horror, I think, is almost a separate thing. I think it's almost, you know, where people are getting awards for horror and they didn't even know they were writing it. I think horror is an adjective, almost.
Would you apply the same to romance?
Yes, I would. And to comedy, for that matter. And each of them are also genres. There is a romance genre. There is a horror genre. But you can certainly have romance science fiction, romance, I would dare label some things like, you know, some of the writings of Lois McMaster Bujold as being romantic and similar to romance novels, even if they don't have a woman in gothic skirts. Gothic clothing, you know, running onto a hillside. And certainly, God knows, there's a lot of romance fantasy out there and a lot of romance horror. You know, a lot of what you see in the bookshelves are love stories with vampires.
Sure. I mean, I think over here, and I can't claim to have surveyed this scientifically, but I think over here it feels like there's more equilibrium between SF getting published and fantasy getting published. And it helps that we have right now a pretty strong crop of British SF writers, like, you know, Alistair Reynolds or Richard Morgan or whoever. And it's a real shame that Gwyneth Jones, who in my view is, you know, one of the half dozen most important writers of SF full stop, seems to have stopped publishing, at least for the moment. But because we have a lot of people who are really, as it were, cognitively interested in SF, then it feels like you can still partake of both, and it's not the case that the one is crowding the other off the shelves or anything.
I mean, obviously it's all a marketing and publishing thing that is happening here. Although, you know, at the same time here, when you look at a lot of the independent presses, I don't want to call them small presses anymore, it's true that I don't know. I would say the vast majority of them seem to me to be horror right now. And they tend toward the supernatural horror, or at least the weird. And weird, of course, is like a whole other. A whole other thing.
How would you categorize the career of someone like Lucius Shepard? You know, he writes very stories that are set in very much the same kind of world, you know, from the start of his career in the mid-80s right through now. They're always very distinctively Lucius Shepard stories. And with the exception of that particular clump of dragon stories that he's done, of the sort of four or five novellas, they're all, it feels to me, of a piece in their view of the world and how people act and how the world and the fantastic might be in touch. But how you categorize them, I think, is a debate that's never going to be decided.
Oh, there is a definitive answer. He writes in the genre of Lucius Shepard.
Yeah.
That's the name of his subgenre. No question about it. no matter what the topic, no matter whether they're his dragon stories or his science fiction set in South America. And they are of a work. I argued that also with writers like George Alec Effinger, who was sort of a genre-busting type of person, where, you know, the closest that I could find some of his stuff was maybe Kafka-esque, which is, by the way, a name of a new anthology that just came out.
This is the Jim Kelly, John Kessel one?
Yes. I got it in the mail just a little while ago. Introduction by Carol M. Schwiller, appropriately, and you know, how do you discuss Kafka?
Yeah. Well, I mean, this, I always get a little frustrated when people are talking about writer's voice, and just boil it down to what their style is like. As you know, for me, a writer's voice is far more about what their concerns are, how they address them, how they structure their stories, how they pace their stories, what kinds of characters they have. And so Gwyneth Jones, who I was talking about earlier, has written an incredibly diverse set of novels when you look back at her 20 years of work. You know, you have Divine Endurance, her first book, which is a sort of Cat Odyssey in weird future Singapore. You have Escape Plans, which is very linguistically dense SF. You have the sequence that began with Boulder's Love, which is almost a, if I can put it like this, a near future fantasy about myths of England and myths of music. And yet they're all very clearly by the same person. They all have the same kinds of concerns. They have same, I suppose, impatience with orthodox explanations or orthodox excuses for why the world is the way it is. And that's far more about voice to me than what sort of sentences an author writes.
Yeah. No, I would have to agree, and I'm actually not a fan of using the concept of voice and style as defining their literature, or if so, that's a different conversation again. That's separate from the genre question. That's simply a stylistic question. And fully legitimate one. But, you know, to me, again, it's almost something like the term horror, which, again, I find is something that can be applied to a story, but you can also say a story is comedy.
Sure. Well, I mean, to a greater or lesser extent, horror is a genre named after its effect.
Yes.
You know, and comedy, it's fairly clear what the effect ought to be, that a successful comedy makes you laugh. And, of course, you can combine the two. You can have horror comedies as well.
Absolutely. But, and you can have horror, comedy, science fiction.
I think this is one of the reasons I'm relatively impatient with subgenre debates and divisions and so on. Not to say that a label like cyberpunk isn't useful in some senses, but it's always going to be reductive. Any act of labeling is always going to create a binary, you know, things either are or aren't X, and it makes it more restricting to the works that are edge cases, the works that escape any kind of easy categorization. And so, just to segue a second, lots of the writers who've been involved with the revival of Doctor Who, I'm pretty sure Russell T. Davies has said this isn't a science fiction series. That even though it has time travel and even though it has outer space and planets and the future, think of it as a fantasy series or an adventure series, which just happens to use a certain set of props.
Although I would say that generally they try to find, you know, enough of an inner explanation for what they do to give it a rigid set of rules,
yeah,
or you know, at least on a season-by-season basis.
Hmm. Yeah, and I mean, one of the classic story structures of Doctor Who is something that looks mythic and actually has a rational explanation. And that was true in the Daemons back in John Pertwee's era, and it's true of Curse of the Black Spot in this last season.
Mm-hmm.
That you have something that, in both cases, looks photogenic and striking and mythic and fantasy-ish. And the arc of the episodes is the Doctor finding out that science does still work, that this phenomenon is in fact amenable to a scientific explanation.
Right. And you know, and you can write anything. You can, you know, put dwarves and elves in there and then say, oh, yes, well, this turned out to be an alternate universe. And all of a sudden, dwarves and elves are science fiction.
And, of course, again, we get into definitional questions. You know, if I don't know if you've ever talked to Jeff Ryman on the show.
2 weeks ago.
It's a small world. But
it was recorded from ReaderCon, as a matter of fact, but I broadcast it 2 weeks ago.
His argument, of course, with mundane SF is that there's almost a political moral duty on SF writers not to go beyond what can reasonably be imagined, because it's almost kind of irresponsible to do so, that the world is saddled with such big problems. That to imagine, say, FTL travel or hyperspace or immortality is avoidance. It's dodging what we're stuck with in the here and now.
Yeah, and by the way, I think I have read arguments that simply using time travel means it's fantastic, because so far most of science seems to repudiate the possibility of time travel.
Yeah, and this is my personal disagreement with people trying to draw a line around hard SF. The argument around hard SF is that we who are hard SF writers, being rigorous and pure in how we use science, and those other people over there aren't being. But the problem is, all science fiction involves some kind of hand waving around the science it uses.
Mm-hmm.
All science fiction, to some extent, is making guesses and hypotheses. It's a question of degree, is a difference of degree rather than of kind, between imagining, I don't know, what a next generation nuclear reactor would be like, or imagining what the surface of Mars would be like, to imagining time travel. It's not, I'd suggest, a difference of kind. It's just a continuum between the two.
And if you're going to label something that rigidly, I mean, poor, you know, Stan Robinson, Kim Stanley Robinson, said that by the time Red Mars came into print, they were finding out stuff at such an incredible rate that there were inaccuracies. And now, what is it, 20 years later, my God, or something like that, it has enough wrong in it that if you're going to hold it up to the cold light of Martian day, it doesn't work anymore, because maybe the permafrost can't work like A, B, or C or something like that. And it's ridiculous to say, well, this is or isn't the following. So maybe what we have to do is embrace soft science fiction along with the hard science fiction.
Yeah. And I mean, obviously, in terms of the encyclopedia, as I was saying, whatever personal views, I might have or any of us might have, I think we try and submerge them to an extent because we want a version of the field represented here that as I say, is broad church, that anyone with an interest in the field can pick up and say, okay, that makes sense to me from where I'm standing.
Right.
But...
So I think, you know, I want to summarize this part because, believe it or not, largely thanks to the technical problems I had at the beginning, we have 20 minutes left.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to get on to at least one other topic, but I want to not exactly close this, but bring up one summation, is that I don't think the problem Well, yes, the problem is, as you said, pinpointing and thereby limiting all these little subgenres. But I think that there is a greater issue. We, you know, forget the trees. We need a new name for the forest. Maybe that new name is speculative fiction. I don't know.
Yeah, and the problem is you're talking about a number of overlapping things here. You're talking about how authors think of it. You're talking about how readers think of it. In particular, you're talking about how the market thinks of it. And the market has the category science fiction and what goes with that. I guess quite deeply ingrained at this point into a distribution system and an expectation of what sells and how you sell it and so on. And to remake that or unmake that is probably not a trivial thing. And so how long did it take from, say, Anne Rice writing her books to there being a category in the stores called paranormal romance? Probably quite a while.
Yeah. But also, as a result of her writing those books, a great many other writers, which I think with greater literary merit, began following in that form, building a genre or a subgenre in there.
Sure.
But you know, I do this radio show, and which has existed for, you know, a couple of score now, and, you know, I say science fiction, fantasy, and related fields of endeavor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and this is why I make what I consider my forgivable faux pas, and I say it on purpose not to rile people, but to open the conversation that maybe when I say science fiction, I might be including Tolkien, who is by definition so obviously not SF.
Okay.
But yet is informing the same reader. I think that the same reader who likes, let's say Ken Stanley Robinson, since I mentioned him before, will very well enjoy Lord of the Rings.
Okay, can I just, I suppose, ask one more question, then, slightly being devil's advocate?
Please.
Why is it that we as a field are so fond of definitions and genres and subgenres and categorization? Clearly we are.
I mean, it goes back to Hugo Gernsback, you know, who came up with science fiction, and then, you know, and then Campbell, and I guess, you know, amazing and fantastic. They actually developed immediately two magazines to differentiate the two. I'm not sure. It's a great question. I don't have a ready answer, although I can say that over the years there have been many episodes of this program, and no doubt zines and critical stuff. Spin Rat has written on the topic very well. He wrote an essay, which I loved years ago, telling the difference between science fiction and sci-fi.
I'm always a little, I know, as it were, inside the corral, we say it's SF and not sci-fi, and that's fine. But I do worry just a little that the label sci-fi gets used to as a marker for us to say, oh, X isn't a proper SF fan if they say sci-fi. This seems to me a really silly way of going about things, you know.
I used to be...
If someone's enthusiastic about it and calls it sci-fi, what's the problem with that?
Well, I'll tell you why I was an anti-sci-fi snob, and now I simply accept it as a abbreviation. But unless I'm mistaken, I believe that the term originated in Famous Monsters of Filmland by Forry Ackerman.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he used it to describe the monster movies of the 50s. And to throw that into the same genre in which I would say, with a book like Gravity's Rainbow, along with, the Gorilla Beast, isn't quite the same thing. I would say one is serious literature and the other is, you know, a silly fun romp. And somehow, and I would like to embrace Gravity's Rainbow as SF or science fiction.
Yeah.
But I would, but I feel weird saying, oh, that's a great sci-fi novel.
Sure. But your point is then that sci-fi is automatically a pejorative.
It was for many years, yeah.
And or a marker that someone doesn't understand the history of the term. But I think, you know, we can't...
Well, 50 years later, I have to move on.
Yeah.
16 years.
I was just reading, just before I came down here, the production notes column that Stephen Moffat has just written in the new Doctor Who magazine. And he's talking about the eternal question of is the lead character called the Doctor or is he called Doctor Who? And he says, you know, possibly with a little sarcasm in his voice, what's the point of being a fan if you can't pick on people for not liking the things you like in the right way? And, you know, I do kind of worry that the example of the term sci-fi is used, as I say, as a marker to say, okay, X doesn't like science fiction in the way that we approve of.
Yeah, and I think that I was maybe right about that in the 70s and wrong about that today.
Mm-hmm.
With, you know, exactly the same argument, it's like, Jim, move on. It's now just a definition. It no longer has the history. Sadly, not as many people know who Fory Akerman was. And by the way, I love sci-fi as well as SF.
Mm.
I just saw a distinction, and especially because I have this job on the radio, mass broadcasting and not necessarily talking to fandom, in trying to be a PR person for the field. And in that way, it's you know, often serves me to put on snootiness in the definition. And so, but today I think that's no longer true. Nobody knows that sci-fi was a pejorative, which it was. And nobody knows that it was a subgenre of a particular kind of movie. It didn't even apply to literature. But there was a time, if you said to Philip K. Dick, I understand you write sci-fi, he'd blow up at you.
Sure. But
of course, he'd blow up at all number of things.
I mean, Philip K. Dick, an author profoundly influenced by a pulp writer like A. E. Van Vogt, who, you know, you certainly wouldn't see in respectable literary company.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think it's an example of how the sort of cultural markers that attach to a particular word can change over time.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm so terribly sorry. We're obviously going to have to do more shows and I'll figure out how to make this bleeping system work. I must say, by the way, the telephone here provides far better vocal quality than Skype did.
Okay.
So I may just, you know, have to figure out a cheaper way of using the phone here. WBAI, listener-sponsored radio. It's not, you know, we're not government-funded like the Beeb. And so we scrape for every penny. And so with the time left, do you want to talk Whoville or what would your preferred...
I'm very happy to. I kind of feel like we've not mentioned the encyclopedia much. But
okay, and we really do. And what's more, we need to give the address online.
Yeah, it's www.sf-encyclopedia.com. And we went live about a month and a half ago now with what we're calling a beta text, which is about two-thirds complete. And we are going to be working over the next year, between now and the end of 2012, to fill in all the gaps of the remaining entries that we need to put in there. But for the moment, there's still, I know I'm biased, but I think there's an astonishing number of words there and astonishingly good words. So every author now has a full bibliography attached to their entry. We have hugely expanded our coverage of games, of anime, Japanese cinema from the 1993 edition. And so we have three and a bit million words there already, compared to 1.3 million in the last edition. So even as I say, if there are a few bricks still to be put in the wall, I hope that people can lose themselves, enjoy wandering around, and enjoy what John and David and everyone else have been doing.
It's an incredible resource, and you know, once upon a time, to buy the hardcover, you were laying out a few bucks. Now it's free.
Yeah, and this is part of a Gallants, who are our publishers, Gallants' e-book program, and so the theory is if you read the Robert Silverberg entry and are interested enough, you can click through from Dying Inside to buy the Dying Inside ebook from them. And Gallants obviously have paid us a license fee, and they paid for the website development.
Really?
But
okay.
There's going to be some stuff we look at down the line about making some money.
It has to monetize itself, yeah.
Yeah. For instance, there does seem to be a consistent sense that people would like this as an iPhone app. That they can view offline.
Well, I would rather have it as a Droid app, so there.
I ran a poll, and I think iPhone outdistanced Android by about 2-to-1.
Check that poll again in 2 years.
Because 500 people with the same IP address will all have voted for Android.
No, because that's a whole other conversation that I can get into for a long time. But you know, one is up and coming, and the other is strong. And I always think the iPhone will always be number one. I think it always will be. But I think that you know, arguing 60% over what will be 40% by the time it's fully populated. Especially, by the way, when the tablet wars, you know, yeah. Apple has already won the tablet war. That's fine. But all the Android tablets are coming out in the next year.
And, well, we should see.
And that's very important. And as the Android stuff comes out, being all new and raw and not as polished as the Apple stuff is, it's already in this country outselling Apple 2-to-1. That's sales.
Yeah.
And when you take a look at web traffic, you know this one's delivering more ads than that one. This one's doing that more than that one. I think the better one is the one that people prefer.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not going to say use one or the other, but I do think that people should not ignore one for the other. And I always get annoyed when I see things that are, you know, buy the app. Oh, really? I can't. Why not? You know, me and the 30 million other Android users would like to use it.
But anyway, as far as the SFE goes, I certainly feel uncomfortable about doing things that involve asking people for money until we've got the core text ready.
Yeah. And by the way, and that's the wonderful thing about the web is it is the great equalizer. It is the
sure.
same operating system. You know, the only difference is the browser. And with certain browsers like Chrome, it's the same on all systems. The Linux experience is identical to the Apple experience.
Yeah. So I'm not sure what to say about the SFE beyond, even though it's not complete, we're all very proud of the work we've done so far, and we hope people enjoy it and the community finds it useful, and the community will bear with us as we slot the last bricks into place.
Yeah, it's not a full launch yet. It is a beta, but it is amazing what is already there. I'm not in there yet. I hope one day,
no.
when more critics and you know, I figure 40 years of doing science fiction radio entitles me to something. But
we've just someone who thought they were going to be able to do all the critic entries and turned out not to be able to. So we've just found another very, very distinguished person who we hope will be able to take that on. So I think you will see the critic entries expanding quite rapidly over the next few months.
Yeah, of course, I'm not a critic. I'm a presenter. As in English parlance, that's really what I am. I'll have my own opinion, but I don't have the chops like you or Clute or Gary Wolfe. There aren't enough women critics. There are commentators like Le Guin, but thinking about it, there aren't that many women critics, are there?
Well, I think, I think there are plenty. I mean, Farah Mendelssohn over here has written some really, really sensible work.
No, she's great. She's great.
On fantasy.
The John Russ stuff she's done, yeah.
Helen Merrick, who's writing some of the entries for us.
That's Joanna a new Russ, name for me.
An absolutely central critic for the field.
She was, yeah.
Le Guin, who you mentioned. Veronica Hollinger. There are plenty of people who've written about it. I suspect maybe a bit more on the academic side, but I mean, even in the mainstream, Elizabeth Hand, who reviews for FNSF, I mean, she's a friend, and I'm biased, but
it's interesting. The majority of women who you've mentioned are published writers who do commentary, and you're right; they are largely academic.
Well, I mean, Adrienne Martini, who wrote, I think, still writes Book Slut and writes for Locus, is a terrific reviewer. But I mean, Liz Hand, I've been saying this for ages, and she always sort of ducks out of it. I think is as good a reviewer as we have, and really, really ought to collect her reviews in a book just as other people have.
Yeah, I love her fiction. I have to admit, I have not. I've even read her comics, but I have not read her nonfiction.
Yeah. And I mean, Justine Labalestier, of course, was largely an academic before she became.
That's right. When I met her, that's exactly what she was doing. She was compiling information for her nonfiction work. Mm. And she became a writer after.
And I mean, I'm sure there are more names that would occur to me if I had the ESF Encyclopedia open in front of me.
Yeah.
But from where I'm sitting, there are really plenty of female critics of SF, both practicing writers and otherwise.
Well, I guess the problem is mine, that they're not as known to me.
Hmm.
This is horrid that we are out of time. I've actually started my outro music, which I think you should now be able to barely hear.
Just about.
Yeah, well, that's the idea. I'm keeping it underneath us. But I have to go off in New York, what is 3 a.m., which is in 2 minutes.
Okay.
And
well, we've barely mentioned Doctor Who. But
yeah, we haven't scratched the surface on nothing.
Okay.
We had a fun conversation about one unanswerable topic and a conversation that's been going on for a century.
And this goes up on the WBAI website soon, doesn't it? On your
It's on the website as of about 5 minutes from now.
Lovely.
So if you go,
I assume you're chopping out the first 20 minutes.
If the problem is that I cannot. I am going to find a way to put that the remaining part online so people don't go to that archive.
I think the first 20 minutes might put people off a little. Oh,
can't begin to tell people how much it put me off. And I apologize to everybody and to you. We will do more shows. I'm going to talk to you, Graham, about how we're going to accomplish that. Because the idea of having you live, by the way, and waking you up early in the morning was so that we could do phone calls, which we didn't have time for.
Absolutely.
Otherwise, we could have recorded this sucker. At any rate, thank you so much, and I will find a way to put an archive without the first 20 minutes online.
Wonderful.
And I will send you that information before the weekend is out.
Thanks very much indeed, Jim.
Thank you so much, Graham.
Okay.
Oh, and let's,
have
by the
day.
Way, okay, you too. And let's, by the way, tell people that if you're looking for Graham Slight online, it's SLEIGHT.
Yep. So, as and in sleight of hand, as I keep telling people.
Ah, there you go. Yeah, for those of us who can spell.
I both pronounced it and introduced myself the same as the character Ollie Slight in the Gibson novel Spook Country.
Oh,
and
okay.
I've always wondered if there's a connection.
There could be. I have to ask Bill sometime. Thanks, Graham. And I'll talk
Thanks,
to you Jim. Offline very soon.
Okay, all the best.
During the day. Cheers. Take care.
Bye.
Cheers. Bye-bye. And thank you all for listening. I'm sorry for running over this far, Lister. The theme is going out right now. And it's over. It's over, actually. It stopped playing. You see, I have a trick. No matter how much I'm running over, I start my theme on time. So that I'm done. I don't know if you were listening. I had the worst first 20 minutes.
You're kidding.
In which, well, you know what? And I would have cured it. It would have been fine if I had asked you to begin with how to do it. Because the problem is I was calling London. Mm-hmm. And I didn't realize, because I only heard the first hour of your show.
Yeah.
I didn't realize you do that like every week.
Hey, why not?
And Skype didn't work.
Ooh.
And then there were problems with the outgoing call, and there was no like nobody to shout to.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I didn't know once the call was done how to. Yeah, I didn't know I had to press, of all things, the off button.
Next time, just piss on it and it will be all right.
Okay, yeah, that is the solution for a lot of things at WBAI. Pee on it. And I have actually worked out sometimes kicking it.
Ooh.
It's also, you know, it works, especially if it's this computer right under the table here. So it was like the worst 20 minutes and wasted with this wonderful guest in London, mm-hmm. where I just didn't get him on. And I made him wake up at, what is it, 6:30 a.m. is when my show starts in London, right?
Yeah.
And they're 5 hours ahead.
Mm-hmm.
So... blah. And he and I had so much to talk about, that we barely scratched the surface.
Next time, scratch your back.
Yeah, but actually, at some point, I'm going to ask you for a tutorial.
I will.
On long distance calling from WBAI.
No problem, no problem.
When I leave, you can remember I said with the last words on my lips that I am a revolutionary. And you're going to have to keep on saying that. You're going to have to say that I am a proletarian. I am
a revolutionary. The red, white, and blue spit on you.
Trying to reach my freedom of speech and expressing myself, torturing the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth. Put on hold, the bold lose control, so they force obedience. Have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth? That's all the way I see it. Well, I'm going off berserk, cause the system works to jerk my people, the people all around the pigs work. Tell me I'm wrong, though. That's my right in this writing the Constitution. Yo, that's an illusion, huh? Suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover, the red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm no lover of this flag, like many others take the same turn. Like me, they yearn for the flag too. We'll be right back.
but this time not on a slave ship. Let's find the people who hate this. These are the places we'll hit.
Panama, talking about Peru, Azania, Brixton, Belfast, and forget Korea, Beirut, and forget Haiti, Iran, Puerto Rico, Colombia, Mexico. Talking about Uptown, Harlem, New York City, y'all, and Nicaragua, East and South Central LA, California, IA, Miami, do or die, Bed-Stuy, never ran, never will, Brownsville, boogie down, South Bronx, yeah.
My man Joey to jail, and now they got him in court because he burned the flag. That's the name of the game. Well, I quit playing. I doubt the suckers want you to hear what I'm saying about this nation. Freedom supposed to be the format, but I step on your flag like it's a floor mat. Maim and mangle, the star spangled. I'm not trying to diss you. I use the flag like toilet tissue to wipe my black ass. What? You think that I'm a jackass? I see a flag and I attack fast with some fire. My desire to burn what Betty Ross sold up. The truth I show up about America, America, home. The free book. This is the home of the slave. Now hold on just a mother minute. You gave me freedom of speech in the First Amendment. So why wanna scold me when I torch the flag? I'm only doing what you told me. You don't like it, so what? I'm not scared of you. Your flag, America too. See, I made up this new rule and I want y'all to learn it. Strike a match to the American flag and burn it.
Tonight, sink a list alive, yeah, WBAI.
Woo! That won't it hurt.
Hell yeah. Yeah, yeah.
There once was a part that won't it hurt.
Hell yeah, yeah, yeah.
I know she's confused, she's my blood sister. Don't need a blues that she's about to shiver. Only a child in the middle of a war. She's a hot child, not because of a diva.
Don't you worry.
Hey, my pa, what the hell is wrong with you?
99 Saint Calista Live right here until 5 o'clock. FRN Free Speech Radio News comes in at 5 o'clock. Al Jazeera kicks in just before a brand new 6 o'clock wake-up call right here. We're going to have a special program today because, you know, today is a day that they screwed
at the, end of
the indigenous people. You know that, right?
Yeah, the Misgiving Day.
13 minutes after 3 o'clock right here. Burn Baby Burn style. We say overthrow Wall Street. O-W-S. By the way, you can get a t-shirt now. All you got to do is write Burn Baby Burn Wall Street right here. 120 Wall Street on the 10th floor. You say, Lister, get me that overthrow Wall Street t-shirt. Clappers. Skid it, skid it, skid it, skid it, skid it, skid it, skid it. OWS, y'all. Yeah, yeah. Skid it, skid it, skid it, skid it, skid it, skid it, skid it. OWS. Mission possible. Overthrow Wall Street. Now, now. Now, now. Yeah, it's your turn to burn, baby, burn right here on a Thursday morning, 3 o'clock until 5 o'clock, where we burn the American flag, all glory to ashes. Yes, I am, yes. We say burn, baby, burn Wall Street, OWS. Overthrow Wall Street. Get it, get it, get it, get it. Live 99 Cinco.
London and calling to the faraway towns. Now war is declared and battle come down. London calling to the underworld. Come out of the cupboard, you boys and girls. London calling, now don't look to us. Phony Beatlemania has bitten the dust. London calling, see we ain't got no swing except for the rain. The crunch of thing, the ice is coming, the sun's zooming in, meltdown expected, the wheat is going thin, engines stop running, but I have no fear, cause London is drowning. I live by the river, to the imitation zone, forget it brother, you can go it alone. London calling, to the zombies of death, quit holding out and draw another breath. London calling, and I don't wanna shout, but while we were talking, I saw you nodding out. London calling, see we ain't got no hide, except for that one with the yellowy eyes. The ice is just coming, the sun's zooming in, engines stop running, the wheat is going thin, a nuclear error. But I have no fear, cause London is drowning out. I live
cause London is drowning. Some of it was true. London calling at the top of the dial. And after all this, won't you give me a smile? London calling. I never felt so much like now.
Tonight, Sinker List Alive right here on the radio, WBAI, y'all. So we're doing it on a Thursday, y'all. Your Thursday is a Friday, your Friday is a Saturday, your Saturday is a Sunday. 99 Cinco, List Alive, yeah, yeah, yeah.
La 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 la.
Hey.
La 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 la.
Hey, hey.
La 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 la.
21209. 2900, get it off your chest, hard and stiff. Could have never miss, y'all.
I knew her and she knew me, but she asked me to introduce them. When I did, we were three until she tried to seduce him.
I really thought our love was much too strong.
Don't tell. Do nothing but a little. like a junkie that needs a shot. Hey, breathing
the robber's plan.
Love is solid and warm. Don't know where love will stay. As sure as life lives, love will stay. It's corrupting everywhere.
Love ain't too close for most, but with his can make it even.
Love ain't too close for most, but with his can make it even.
Sing a list alive on the radio right here at 99.5. 3 o'clock on until 5 o'clock. We do it. We burn the American flag to ashes. That's why we had to call the show Burn Baby Burn, y'all. Clap balls, duck, toy, toy, fishbone. Playing all the reggae music they refuse to play on the reggae shows. There's a bunch of cowards, y'all. Love and hate. Dennis Brown up next, y'all. Burn Baby Burn, y'all. Yes, I am. 99.5.
Hey,
yeah, hey, hey, I am. 99.5 list alive. Duh, duh. OWS, y'all.
And it is hope.
Overthrow Wall Street. Duh, duh.
Love. Love and heaven's the inhabitant of love.
Alive, y'all. Produce Melissa. Yeah, yeah. Tighter, baby. Tighter. Get him up, get him up, get him up, get him up. Woo! Burn, baby, burn. 99.5, Dennis Brown. Musical request off a listener's chest. Hard and stiff and couldn't ever miss, y'all. So we do it. Yo, so we do it. Ganja smoking time, make it 42 minutes after 3 o'clock. So we do it. Dedicating this to the man from the Midnight Ravers, y'all. Terry Wilson, your boy on the radio. Listen.
Here I come with love and not hatred. Shall follow I all the days of my life. Give me no one, no wish to be with no evil man. For there come the day when you'll be whipped by the feather's end. Leave a brute's children. Oh, oh yeah.
hear them tune, yeah. This is what we call rockers. Rockers. Yes, I am.
My cup running over.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Surely goodness and mercy shall follow I all the days of my life.
Yo.
Love and hate can
99 Cinco list alive right here until 5 o'clock, 5 o'clock. You know it got ready. Punto Eseguida. 43 minutes on the outside, 43 minutes after 3 o'clock. 212-209-2900, you know what to do, y'all. Yo, draw Augustus Pablo. Draw Augustus Pablo. Selecta.
And my cup running over. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow I all the days of my life. Can't be the one, no wish to be with no evil man. For there comes the day when you'll be weaned by the Father's hand. Liverpool's children, oh, oh yeah.
Thank you.
In time, make it 54 minutes after 3 o'clock, 99 Sinker List Alive right here until 5 o'clock, Free Speech Radio News. Al Jazeera kicks in before Wake Up Call, yeah.
didn't teach me that I cannot learn from Mistress Attaway.
Licking bug from the
dog. I don't got a lot in class, but I know it doesn't come in a shot glass. They try to make me go to rehab, but I said no.
Lincoln Park no, from the top.
Yes, I've been black, but when I come back, you will know. No, no.
Lincoln Park from the top.
I ain't got the time, and if mommy thinks I'm fine, they try to make me go to rehab, but I won't go. Why do you think you are here? I said I got no idea. Am I gonna lose my baby? So I always keep a bottle near.
Got the weed, I
am.
Sense of mania. Good old lamb's bread. Excuse me. Woo! In the USA, imperialist America, they treat weed like democracy. It's illegal. You ever see a thing like that?
Again.
Damn, tell them. Love that tune, yeah. And the video.
I just need a friend.
Tighter, baby, tighter.
I'm gonna spend 10 weeks.
Yes, I am. In Atlanta.
Of everyone.
Oh, you mean?
Think I am on the mend.
More fire, more weed, more fire.
It's not just my pride.
Yes, I am.
It's just. Till these tears I've dried.
Produce me, Lista, produce me.
Because I let me go to rehab.
Yes, I am.
I said no, no, no.
More lamb spread, hydroponics, yes, sensomania, ganja. Write yourself. 99 single, no, list alive.
No, no.
Yes, I am. 631-632-690.1 FM if you're in the mood for some good old weed. You know what we do best right here, y'all. Burn, baby, burn, y'all. Yes, I am. You're tuned to Pacifica Radio 99 Cinco. Pacifica Radio WBAI 99.5 FM, New York. WBAI.RG. New York, New York. So wicked, we had to name it twice. Si, senor. Ahí nada más.
Enciende la llama que busca la vida. Enciende la llama sin semilla. Enciende la llama que abra mucho tu corazón de besa. El que a muchos se le olvido es que tanto pensar. Nadie para mirar y nadie. Yo digo que la vida es otra cosa mucho más.
4 o'clock on the dot, punta enseguida, yo. At exactly 40 degrees on the outside, y'all. No aya, no aya kaya. No aya kaya on the inside. Yes, aya. Who's got the weed? Who's got the fire? Clappers.
Dulces en semilla.
Traduzca, por favor. Mario Morile, this is for you.
Enciende la llama sin semilla. Enciende la llama que busca la vida.
Errol Maitland, this is for you, I am. Yes, I. Roberto, Roberto, Robert Knight, this is for you, I am. Yes, I.
Pero no, si ves no estará llamando, oh, en tu amor, no si ves no estará llamando, oh, no si ves no estará llamando, oh, no si ves no estará llamando, oh, de tu amor, oh, 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 ¿cómo se siente? ¿Cómo se siente?
¿Cómo se siente?
called OWS just because we're poor. Overthrow Wall Street. No apology. Yeah.
I come in so I'm bloody.
Hell yeah. Hell yeah. OWS. Overthrow Wall Street. In Tahrir Square. Yeah.
Well, guess what? We're not giving up.
Yeah.
Just because I'm poor.
In Capetian. Yeah, yeah. Booyah City. 99 Cent are listed live right here. 212-209-2900, y'all. Just because. Just because. The great HR right yourself. Remember HR from Bad Braids. 99 Cent are listed live. Playing all the music they refuse to play right here. 99 Cent are listed live. So did y'all. HR. Just because I'm poor. Right here. Yeah. Puss and dog get together. Why can't we make revolution in the belly of the beast of imperialist America and just overthrow Wall Street? OWS. No election on the occupation. The proletariat's in the street, burn baby burn style. Yeah. In Tahrir Square. No election on the military occupation. The operatives of the imperialists. You know what I mean? Think about it. Think about it. Think about it. The Egyptian military. The Commodores. The Egyptian military. You know? The operatives of the imperialist US forces. The military of Egypt. Can't fool the proletariat, the masses anymore. Just because they're poor, y'all. Aya, OWS. Overthrow Wall Street, y'all. Get the t-shirt. One of David Katz's favorite tune right here in the morning. Co-host of Burn Baby Burn heard 3 until 5 o'clock. Free speech radio news comes in at 5 o'clock. Then Al Jazeera Live. Al Jazeera News right here exclusively. 99 Cent Lista Live, WBAI. 6 o'clock wake up call. 8 o'clock Amy Goodman with something special. On the day that they murdered pillage indigenous people in imperialist America. David Katz, morning. How are you feeling this morning?
Just good morning, listener.
Hey, happy Turkey Day to you. Hey, David. Yeah. David, guess what I got for you?
I
got this recipe of the Al Qaeda website. This is what you do. You get one of them turkey frying things from the USA, right? And you get a turkey. You fry the Twinkie and stick the Twinkie in the turkey, and then you drop the Twinkie in, and then all hell breaks loose. Fried turkey, and the whole town catch a fire. Amazing, isn't it? I saw this thing on television, right, where the Homeland Security people are warning you about becoming a turkey terrorist. Buy this thing, you know, you just drop it in. This thing is like a round tub, and you fill it up halfway with not kerosene oil, let's say like some oil from Italy, you know, olive oil. And you get your turkey, man. And then you get your Twinkie and stick a Twinkie in your turkey, or you fry your Twinkie and then stick it in the turkey. And you drop this whole wet turkey dripping with water into this oily stuff, and it just like a volcano.
What you mean? Because there's so much toxic stuff in the Twinkies. What do you mean?
Yeah, that's right. It's a combination of everything, man. Twinkie turkey. Yeah. How you doing in London, England?
Yeah, well.
Happy Misgiving Day to you, as we say here at 99 Central.
What can I say, Lister? Here it's sunny and cold, and teetering on the brink of economic collapse. But, yeah.
it's crazy.
That's the way it is.
Yeah, well, what's happening is that the imperialist operatives are being kicked out of Egypt because the masses of proletariat have risen up again. Egyptian protesters want elections scheduled for Monday to be postponed and cancelled, and a council of elders to replace the military rulers who on Wednesday been killing off the people and beating them up.
I know.
Amazing, isn't it? Amazing.
Yeah,
amazing.
It's really,
amazing.
Yeah. But, you know, I mean, I guess they're taking stock. But when they had that initial kind of euphoria when they got Mubarak out of the way, but
the regime remains.
And just brutalizing people, and you know, as you say, I mean, killing them off by the dozens.
It's the same problem in Yemen. That clone signed some document in Saudi Arabia, saying that he's stepping down and transferring power to his closest ally, and the regime stays in place, right?
Yeah.
Sad.
I think part of the problem is, you know, again, these states, you're talking about places where they have not had democracy at all. You know, they've just been ruled by despotic dictators for all these decades.
Right.
Often, obviously, with that sort of support and legitimacy provided by West, you know, the European nations and the U.S.
Yeah.
And so there isn't really a strong opposition that's waiting in the wings, you know, ready to come in.
Right.
And then even the democratic process isn't really part of that landscape. So, you know what I mean? It's even when they're able to cut off the head of the Hydra, then, you know.
Yeah.
They've got the whole state and military apparatus to contend with.
I know.
I mean, it still remains to be seen how things can go in Libya, too.
It's really sad, though. Really, really sad. I mean, this guy in Yemen killed a lot of people, right? And he's not going to go to no court, not even the international court. So, Saudi Arabia is a place to go where you don't want to be touched, is that it?
Yeah,
they can't kick you out and ship you to some international court or to some court in Yemen to be tried, right? After more than three decades of autocratic rule, El President Ali Abdullah Saleh, the clown that has been killing off a lot of people in Yemen, on Wednesday, immediately transferred power to his vice president, bowing to unrelentless street protest demonstration of the people in the streets who he has been killing off. And they hope that this is an end to the political crisis that he has created. But again, like you say, you chop off the head and the body just comes up like a body snatcher and just attacks one more time. But I'm convinced that these people are learning from the mistakes in Egypt, where when you think you have it, you just don't, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I hope you're right, Lister, but, you know.
Yeah.
So, it's a whole... there's so many things to contend with in that situation.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So
what's happening politically on the streets of London, Stan?
Yeah, well, it's more of the same, pretty much, since we spoke last time. I mean, there's been some other sort of developments economically, like, you know, Thomas Cook, the big travel firm, is teetering on the brink of going under. I mean, their share price dropped from £2 a share to, like, down to, I don't know, 75p or like, something ridiculous like that. So, I mean, the fear is that they're gonna go and, you know, go bust.
Yeah.
And if they go bust, you're talking about thousands of jobs. Mm-hmm. And you're also talking about a lot of travelers that would be stranded somewhere.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, if you remember a few years ago, there was that thing when XL Airlines went bust. You remember XL Airlines? This kind of...
Remind me.
Well, the XL was a budget charter airline that flew to places like St. Kitts.
Yeah, like the Kiribati lines,
Yeah, they flew all over the Caribbean, and they were used by a lot of Caribbean people to go home, to go and visit family. And that,
especially this time of the year,
Yeah, because they were affordable.
Sure.
And, you know, they went bust overnight, and they literally were selling tickets, like, up till 10 minutes before they went bust.
Yeah.
And they had this situation that they had a load of planes in different parts of the Caribbean and different parts of the world. And there were people there on the planes, and they're ready to take off on the runway. And the ones that took off before the announcement was made that they went bankrupt.
Yeah.
Took off and flew and went home. And then the announcement was made, sorry, we've gone bankrupt. And then the ones that hadn't taken off yet,
right?
Everybody had to get off the plane.
In the middle of the air? In the middle of the sky?
Wherever they were. And then they were all stuck there.
Damn.
And what happened was, you know, those airlines are regulated by this authority, the Air Transit Authority, ATOL. And so anything regulated by ATOL, the passenger is guaranteed to get their money back or get alternate flight arrangements made. But when it happened, and this is a body that, they guess who's backing them up? It's taxpayers' money. So, you know, it costs like millions of pounds to get everybody home.
Right.
When XO went bust, and it was this big, big chaotic thing. And since then, this was 3 years ago, Lister, three and a half years ago. Since then, ATOL's had this huge deficit, millions of you know, in the red.
Right, right.
And so the fear is, you know, here's Thomas Cook, share price plummeting to, sorry, I think it was 10p last night. It went from £2 to 10 pence share price.
Right.
And last month, they'd gone to the bank and they'd borrowed something like, I think it was, I don't know, 140 million pounds or something. And then they've just gone back to the bank this month and said, oh, sorry, we need the same again. We need another 100 million. And, you know, they've got debts of... I don't know how much they're trying to say. Maybe if things continue like this, their debts would be 1.5 billion pounds by the end of next year. So, but, you know, Thomas Cook is saying, oh, no, don't worry, everything's fine. We're not going under.
Yeah.
Everything's just as good as it was yesterday. And so, you know, that just kind of is an indication of the financial health of the nation and its businesses right here.
Amazing. Amazing. Well, here in New York City, where crony capitalism still exists, federal prosecutors in Manhattan have agreed to drop charges against a real estate developer who was charged in the political corruption case that ensnared State Senate Carl Krueger and seven other people, according to the court documents at hand. The developer, Aaron Malinsky, had been accused by the prosecutors of paying about $472,000 in bribes to a shell company linked to Mr. Krueger, a Brooklyn Democrat, in return for the senators taking official acts. The senators taking official acts on behalf of Mr. Malinsky's project as opportunities arose. So that's that, what's happening in New York City here. What is happening on your side in London there?
Well, there's a big public sector worker strike that's going to happen next week on Wednesday. And you remember last week I was talking about this thing with the border with document checkers relaxing the checks on, you know, people coming in at Heathrow and at ports and airports. And there's this big furor that erupted about that the checks were relaxed and the Home Secretary saying she never gave permission.
Right.
The guy in charge saying she did give the permission. And anyway, so because this big strike is coming up, there's all this concern and paranoia about what's going to happen with the border controls, because the border control are all going on strike.
Right.
So, you know, it's now this. It started with the teachers, then it spread to, I think, like NHS staff. And so now, you know, the border control staff have joined the strike. So the first thing that was stated was that they were going to send for all these staff from embassies around the world. They were going to use taxpayers' money fly them back to the UK so that they could be strike breakers. And now they're saying that they're ordering all these civil servants in Whitehall, down where there's a lot of government offices and ministries.
Right.
And they're going to order them in to be strike breakers.
Okay.
So, you know, I'm not quite sure how that one's going to pan out, but, yeah.
It's weird. Retailers in New York City won a victory, actually in Washington, D.C. Retailers won a big victory last summer when the Federal Reserve halved the fees that banks were, banks and credit card companies were ripping people off. Remember that scandal? We're charging people more than necessary stuff to process debt and transactions. You know, for some retailers, however, that was absolutely not enough. This week, trade group representative representing the traders, the retailers, beg your pardon, convinced stores and groceries filed a lawsuit against the Fed, asserting that the board's debt fee rule still allows banks to capture too much money from the debt card purchases. You know, that's interesting, because every time I go in to buy a Twinkie to stuff into a turkey, because I hate turkeys, they say, no, we can't charge that on no credit card. It costs like $10 to charge that one. You know what I mean? So it's amazing. The rule, which went into effect in October, was the subject of fierce lobbying by the banks, the capitalist banks, and retailers over what has grown to be a $20 billion in annual debts and credit card transaction fees. Big fight over that, eh?
Yeah.
Amazing how they can rip people off. 212-209-2900. Let's see if we can get some calls out here. We are speaking to David Katz, co-host of Burn Baby Burn, live from London, England. And, you know, speaking about taking telephone calls, somebody called up and had a question to ask you, David Katz, but I don't remember the question. Hello, caller. You're on the air. Hello.
Hey, how are you?
Hi. Morning. Say hello to David Katz. Go ahead.
Hey, good morning, Mr. Katz. I don't know what you guys are talking about, be honest.
Where are you calling from? Where
I'm
are you calling
from? Brooklyn.
Who is this?
My name is Marcus.
Hey, Marcus.
Now, hear me out.
How you doing, man?
I'm all right.
Cool.
Well, I don't know that really. I am a Hispanic male in my 40s. I don't look it. Tonight, I went over to this Occupy Wall Street.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
How many people are over there?
Maybe about five or maybe there was like 10.
10 persons?
Perhaps.
It's pretty when cold. It's pretty cold out there, right? So,
when I got there, you see, this was what disturbed me. When I got there, I was dealt with racism, being ignored, and being heckled.
Don't say that.
Yes, I did.
Why?
I went through this experience.
Why?
Tonight.
Why?
I have no idea,
why?
Sir. I got there. I went to ask the woman, the little Italian woman, if when the people would gather up, I was totally ignored.
Wait a minute, where is this? At Liberty and Broadway?
Yeah, Liberty and Broadway.
Liberation Square?
I was totally ignored. The woman was even making fun of the Dominican cop.
No.
Okay? Mm. There's a little bit of racism going on over here. Then I received a letter from one of the other men explaining how they're looking for leadership because there's lack of leadership and everyone's going crazy and bizarro over there and spending money and there's a group called the GA that sets up the protest and does all the protesting.
Let me ask you a question. Let me ask you something since you think, and David, help me out, since you think it's so bizarre.
No, I don't think it's bizarre. This was just my experience.
All right, well, let's resolve this. How do you think best we should resolve this contradiction? How do you think we should just resolve this?
You know,
one of the first things... Be honest now, all right?
This is one of the... See, I've been dealing with this kind of racism since I've been a kid from these people.
I understand that, but
now,
you're not listening to the question.
Yeah, I heard what you said. And this is what I'm suggesting.
Go ahead.
Instead of this slapping each other on the wrist saying, don't be racist, that's bad. We should expose the invention and the inventors and the people who created the race issue. That was a German doctor. His name was Johann Friedrich Blumenbach. In 1775, he invented the concept and idea that human beings were a race.
All right.
This is what needs to be done.
Let me give David Katz a time to bat in. Bat in, David.
You know?
What says you, David?
Yeah, I mean, this is, I mean, it's disheartening to hear the caller's experience. I mean, you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. It's not what it's supposed to be about. This is supposed to be about fighting oppression, then
right.
You're not supposed to be oppressing the other people who are trying to fight oppression with you.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, but what the solution is, I don't know. That's you know, this is difficult other than just confronting the people on the spot and saying, you know, what the hell are you doing? Mm-hmm. What's going on?
Mm-hmm. Hey, caller.
See, my thing is like I was saying,
that
would be the first step. Exposing Johann Friedrich Blumenbach, the man who invented race, and making that the issue so that we know and understand and realize that race is a social construct that was invented and there is no basis for it, which will coalesce with the DNA aspects of it and the other aspects of it. But we tend to leave that aspect out of it because I believe that a lot of people, I don't believe I actually see it, because I've experienced it, that a lot of our so-called leaders are nothing more than poverty pimps. And at the end of the day, they're the ones who are financially benefiting off of this bizarro world that's taking place.
Let me ask you a question lastly before we go, because we're running out of time.
Yeah.
Caller, are you going to go back?
No, I'll just support it in spirit.
All right, I hear you.
I mean, it's not going to deter me, but I just thought that was just, you know. Hey, I'm the guy who broke up the X-Club. playing group by asking them questions when I used to hang out with Sonny Clawson.
I hear you.
A lot of people are fake.
They're pretending.
You know, and that's another thing we need to clear up with these things. You know, who's real and who's fake in all of this stuff?
All right, I got to run, man. Thanks very much. And where are you calling from again?
I'm calling from Brooklyn. Guys, take care.
All right, you take care.
Yeah, all the best. I mean, the call has raised some important issues there, though, Lister. I mean, and it is complicated. You do get some of these events where it's people are just seeing it as an excuse to party or to be, you know, reckless, and they're not really part of the solution. But I understand that.
Well, was it Karl Marx who said that when the revolution starts, it's going to attract all types? Right? Something like
possibly.
That. Right? Possibly. 212-209-2900, OWS Overthrow Wall Street, it's Burn Baby Burn. We do this every Thursday from 3 until FSRN kicks in, Al Jazeera News, and then 6 o'clock wake up call. And then Amy Goodman at 8 o'clock with Democracy Now! More Than Ever. Hello, caller, go ahead. Where are you calling from? Hello?
I'm calling from the village. I'm actually on the graveyard shift.
Oh, boy. Hey, you and Bob Marley on the night shift. Damn. Yeah, how you feeling?
I'm feeling quite well, thank you.
Say hello to co-host David Katz for me in London, England, live. Go ahead.
I just wanted to call in reaction to the last caller.
Please, help me.
And, I think it's really important that, you know, we comport ourselves in a way that we're not so easily affected.
Thank you.
By people's comments or people's disposition.
Exactly.
Because, I mean, at the end of the day, what's the person going to do? Are they going to kick your butt?
Yeah. You know what I mean?
You know, there are plenty of people there to talk to. I've been down there several times and had a positive experience.
Sure.
I've had the experience going down there where I saw a lot of interesting things happening and I overheard a lot of good conversations.
Right.
And I didn't even know exactly how to get into a conversation myself. You know?
I hear you.
I don't attribute that to racism,
even though
I'm a black male.
Right.
But, you know, at the same time, I've also gone down there and I've met a lot of excellent people and had some good conversations and have done some actual movement building. And that's what you're supposed to do.
Right.
You don't go down to an event like that
and
fixate on a comment that somebody made or take the time to be humiliated when usually it's not necessary. I mean, you can either argue with the person if it's worth the time or
you can
move on.
And, you know, the big picture is that they say occupy Wall Street. We say overthrow Wall Street. They haven't even gotten to that level yet, and we're bickering about some backward stuff. We got to go forward, don't you think, bro?
I definitely do. But I think, you know, one big problem that we have in all of this is that, you know, we're all subjective beings.
Mm-hmm.
We all have our own point of view.
Sure.
And there's a lot of brilliant people. I mean, one thing I've been really impressed with is that if you listen to a lot of the footage or a lot of the audio bites from BAI, I mean, so many people out there, the average person you put a microphone in front of is like an able spokesperson for the cause.
David Katz, what do you say, David? Let's get
well,
David.
I hear what you're saying, caller, but on the same side, you know, I wouldn't want to discount the experience of the other, you know, what the other caller was trying to express, because think how disappointing that must feel. You go down there to make a difference, and then you're being treated as though your contribution to making a difference isn't worth it.
Well, you know, I can't speak to you know, that caller's particular experience or negate what happened in that particular situation. I don't know, but I mean, to just fixate on just one negative interaction when, look, there's a lot of crazy people. There's even people who are, you know, misguided in different ways. But I mean, the point is there's a massive movement and it's overdue in this
big
country.
Picture.
And we're going to have to deal with each other.
Big picture.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying.
We're
going
to have to deal with each other. We're going to have to. And that was the point that I wanted to make, was just simply that there's a lot of brilliant people and we all have a lot of great ideas. But I think a lot of people have sort of a syndrome where they feel the need to do maybe 80% of the talking or more in most of the situations that we're in.
I hear
and, you know, I like to talk, I also like to listen. So it's just important that if you're going to sit there and talk to somebody for half an hour, then be prepared to sit there and listen and don't interrupt for half an hour.
All right, let's do some of that. Let's get some more people in right here. 212-209-2900, the Flag Burning Show.
Thanks for your contribution, caller.
All right. That was nice. David Katz, you want to do some more?
Yeah.
All right, 212-209-2900, 212-209-2900. Burn Baby Burn, you on the air. Hello.
Hello,
morning. Where are you from? Where are you calling?
This is me. You talking to?
Oh, how you doing, man? Where you at?
I'm in Brooklyn.
All right, Brooklyn. All right. Say hello to David Katz in London, England. Go ahead.
Yeah, I wanted to make a comment on the last two calls. I think that the first caller, like the guy in England, London, said, you know, don't discount his experience. And to the second call, I think we're living in denial. You know, and we want this Occupy Wall Street thing to be all great and everything. I wrote a piece on it. I went down there, I'm a photographer. I went down there, took some pictures, made some observations, wrote a piece on it. I think that the issue is something that we're ignoring, is that these people came out there because they were affected by a situation, the things that are going on in the country today. But they don't care, and that's the problem, and that was the original problem. They didn't care. You know, these people didn't care when other people were catching hell. And now they're catching hell and they're standing up, but they still don't care. When I went down there, I'm a black man too. I walked through the encampment and everything. I mean, it looked like at every turn I made, a white woman stepped out and looked like she saw a bear in the woods. A killer bear in the woods. Now that was my experience, but let me just, you know, tell you a few other things. As a photographer, you know, I noticed photography equipment. So when I walked through there, I saw these people with some very expensive photographic equipment, and it didn't seem particularly concerned about damaging it or theft or anything like that. Now, that's not a problem, but what occurred to me was, you know, who are these people that can walk around with $6,000 cameras and basically like they had a, you know, a $30 camera on their neck? You know, these are people who aren't the people that I grew up with in the projects in Brooklyn.
All right, well, let me ask you something. OWS, how are we going to overthrow Wall Street, big picture?
Well, my opinion on that.
Yeah.
Well, let me first say, I'm just explaining, you know, what this guy said about.
No, I understand, but your point is well made and all that. But we got to take this to the next level, bro. Yo, bro, listen up. We're gonna have to take this to the next level, man. We're wasting time, man. Time is running out. You know what I mean? Just like
what
this show.
I think we should do. I honestly,
how are we gonna overthrow Wall Street? OWS, overthrow Wall Street. How are we gonna do that? You tell me.
Well, I'll tell you, Alistair. I'll just point in my two cents with.
So
what this caller is saying,
uh-huh,
just reminds me. When I go on the marches down here, and you know, when this the Occupy movement starts happening in London, you do get this sense when you're down there. It's like a little microcosm of society in itself.
Mm-hmm.
So you do get these sort of hierarchies repeating themselves. And it is stratified along race and class lines.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it is a difficult thing to overcome. And I think, you know, I can understand what these callers are trying to express. You know what I mean? It's not so simple to just say, well, I'm going to ignore that I'm being treated the same way I've been treated all my life, even though, you know, we're supposed to be fighting a greater oppressor.
I hear you.
Do you know what I mean?
212-209.
I can appreciate what the caller's saying. And also, caller, who did you write your piece for?
Well, he slipped off because the board is totally full with phone calls, and we're trying to get everybody in right here, David
Punch
Katz.
Punch him in, Lister.
Yes, sorry about that. 212-209-2900, co-host David Katz here live from London, England. Hello, thanks for holding. Hello, go ahead. Hello.
Good morning.
Morning. It's about time we get a woman on the phone here. Go ahead. How are you?
What's the racial component in the London occupation?
David?
Well, I don't have statistics for you on that, but
Sorry?
You know, I don't have statistics for you on that.
Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Flushing, New York. Okay. What I really wanted to say was that I think racism should be made one of the top priorities of this movement.
Mm-hmm.
For several reasons. Mm-hmm. Because it was really slavery and the Native American Indian conquest which started America off on this this spinning into madness with money.
Same thing right here in Britain.
Right?
You know, it's built on the backs of slavery, the whole banking industry.
That's right. And right now, the African-American people are in crisis, not only due to poverty and a kind of disenfranchisement with the very, very poor, but the young people are going absolutely mad, and they're going mad as a result of the kind of self-hatred that media dumps on them constantly, showing them negative images of themselves, never showing the history of black people, the positive history where black young kids can say, oh, we did this, now maybe I can do this. I'm talking about going all the way back to Egypt.
I hear you. All right, Coley, we're going to have to run. Thanks very much. Where are you calling from again? From Queens? All right, thanks very much. And you have a very good day. Keep listening to WBAI. You know, this is a day that they really screwed over the indigenous people in imperialist America, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
I don't celebrate that.
Me too. All right, thanks. Call again, right? 212-209-2900. Running out of time. David Katz, go ahead. Wrap it up for me.
Yeah, well, there's been further developments on that hacking phone scandal, with a lot of testimony from public figures about how having their phone hacked has ruined their lives.
Yeah.
And there was also something having to do with the Baha Moussa case in this man who was tortured to death in Iraq.
Hmm.
And there was action brought against the Ministry of Defense.
Right, right.
And apparently some of the prisoners who'd been suing the Ministry of Defense got some kind of acknowledgement that the Ministry of Defense had acted improperly in allowing them to be tortured. And the Stephen Lawrence murder trial is still hearing evidence about the way that the police...
That's still going on, the Stephen Lawrence?
Yeah, it's probably going to take about 6 weeks, Lister.
Mm-hmm,
it's going to probably be stretching into the new year.
Wow.
The latest thing about 2 days ago that I heard was some of the policemen who had stored the clothing of the accused, and they were talking about the manner in which the clothing had been stored.
Right.
You know, so this has to do with whether or not the evidence has been contaminated. And keep in mind, this all happened, the murder took place 18 years ago. So what they were saying is normally with this clothing, they put it in these bags and they seal it with sellotape.
Wow.
But the policeman who bagged the clothing is saying it's possible he didn't seal it with sellotape. He might have left it open because there was so much blood on the clothing that it would have destroyed the bag if he'd sealed it. Basically.
So sad, man.
Yeah, terrible stuff.
David Katz, want to wish you a happy time in London, England. It's a sad day that in America they're still celebrating, killing off the indigenous people and ripping them off to the ground, you know. But we'll deal with that next week, same place, same time. David Katz, co-host of Burn Baby Burn, right here, 212-209-2900, heard every Thursday, 3 until 5 o'clock, before Free Speech Radio News kicks in with Al Jazeera. News right here at your favorite radio station, 99.5 WBAI. All right, David, we'll catch you next week, same place, same time, right?
Yeah.
All
nice
right.
To be with you once again.
And
just to let you know, Ernest Ranglin was playing in London last night.
Get out of here.
Jazz Cafe.
Where, the Jazz Cafe?
Yeah, Jazz Cafe. Playing
Well, what part of London is
quartet
that?
Quartet style.
What part of London is it, Jazz Cafe?
That's in Camden Town.
Ah, okay. Gotcha.
Yeah, North London, yeah.
Gotcha. So, gotcha.
Quite a good turnout, quite a nice vibe. Ernest still on fine form and in a very good mood.
Great. All right, well, here's some Sinead O'Connor for you and Claudia. All the best, David Katz.
All right, listen.
See you. Bye-bye. Sinead O'Connor.
I'm living while I'm living to the Father I will pray. Only him know how we get through every day. Only I can the price, arm and leg we have to pay. While our leaders play, all I see, people are gonna rob, all a bribe. Thief never love, you see, thief with long back. No love for the people who have suffered real bad. Another toll to the poor, may God help your soul. What is to stop the youth from get out of control? Full upper education, yet no on no payroll. The clothes on the back of countless aisle. Could go on and on, the fool has never been told. I'm living while I'm living to the Father I will pray. Only him know how we get through every day. Only I can the price, arm and leg we have to pay. While our leaders play, I say who can afford to run, will run. But what about those who can't? They will have to stay. Opportunity, a scarce, scarce commodity. In these times I say, when mama spends her last and send you go class, never you ever play. It's a competitive world for low budget people, spending a dime while earning a nickel, with no regard for who it may tickle. My cup is full to the brim. Could go on and on, the fool has never been told. All a bribe, all thief, never love, you see, thief with long bag.